This week in Retronauts, put on your ruby slippers and make a wish. Everyone, welcome to episode 361 of Retronauts. That's we've spun in a full circle, and now we're 1 degree past where we started. I am Jeremy Parrish, and this week I am hosting the first episode in an ongoing series that we're going to be doing throughout this year, looking back at the history of the Street Fighter series. Street Fighter 2 turns 30 years old. Hurts to say that a little bit. All right. Street Fighter 2 turns, yes, 30 years old. This March, actually. So next month, by the time you're listening to this. That's very old. Because I remember playing it when it was the new hotness. Boy, howdy. Nothing ages you like video games. But yes, we are going to look back at the legacy of this series now that the most important and definitive game in the series is 30 years old. And we're going to start here from the beginning with the original Street Fighter and also this strange little game that doesn't really belong to canon, but it's called Street Fighter, so it counts. So joining me here in this first episode of Street Fighter in Retrospect, or whatever we're calling it, we have, let's go in alphabetical order. What is that? Oh, it's JKK. Man, that's tough. So let's start with J. Jeremy, right. And then?
Hi, I'm John Hurst, and I am one of the podcasters on Video Death Loop. I'm kind of going through, and just a huge Street Fighter fan, honestly. So,
all right. That is a good place to be, or a good thing to be for a show like this. So welcome to Retronauts. And next up, let's see, that would be K-E. K-E, okay.
That would be me. I'm Kevin Bunch. I run the Atari Archive YouTube channel and website, and I'm also a semi-retired Street Fighter player.
Don't worry, I'm sure you'll get called back into action one of these days. Just when you think you're out, they pull you back in. That's how it goes. And finally,
I'm Kurt Collada. I run Hardcore Gaming 101, and I also played Street Fighter 2 a bunch when I was a kid, but not so much these other ones.
Yeah, Street Fighter 1 came out 4 years before Street Fighter 2. That's an eternity in 8 and 16-bit video game days. Like, you just didn't see that much of a gap between games, and those still turned out to be a viable franchise back then. So, you know, Street Fighter 1 was not that big a game, at least in the home circuit. Apparently, it was fairly well known in arcades. There seems to be some disagreement about that from the people who were there selling it. So who knows? But in any case, the original Street Fighter was a thing, and Street Fighter 2 came out, and basically everyone forgot about Street Fighter 1. But because of Street Fighter 2, Street Fighter 1 does matter and has more of a legacy than it probably would otherwise. So to really understand what the Street Fighter franchise is about, we do need to go back here to this first game. But actually, we're going to go back in time even further than Street Fighter 1, and we're going to talk about the guy who kind of created Street Fighter, who's, you know, whose brainchild this was, the without whom, and look at his career before Street Fighter, and basically kind of set the context for the subsequent episodes of this series. So, without further ado, let me ask you guys, when was the first time you actually played Street Fighter 1?
So I think the first time I played it was the DOS port around 1993, because my parents had just gotten an IBM PC, and my dad liked Street Fighter 2 and really wanted to try this Street Fighter 1 out, and boy howdy, what a time that was.
There's an appliance store around here called Tops, which was kind of far away, so we didn't go to it very often. But I remember them having they set up a very large TV with the TurboGrafx-16 CD port on it. And that was the first and only time I played it for probably about a decade.
Yes, the CD port, which is notable in history for various reasons, but we'll talk about those later. John, how about you?
I actually got to play the arcade version. It was a few years after Street Fighter II, but we were on vacation somewhere, and in the hotel that we were in, they had a actually decent arcade that had, I remember specifically Golden Axe, but on the other corner was Street Fighter I. It was a six-button version with that that you could do the like strong, medium, fierce, like all that set up there. But that was the first time I ever touched it. And I just remember really, really struggling to, it's like all I wanted to do was throw out a fireball. I just wanted Hadouken, just one, please. And I just.
And the game refused to let you.
Like, no, no. Like, you will not get one of those. but it was, I played it a couple times. I beat a couple of your first opponents. And that was it for a very long time.
Yep. Yeah, Street Fighter 1, not very common. I know Capcom has collected it a few different times. It's been in like different Street Fighter anthologies and classic game anthologies, but I've never actually seen the arcade game myself, even though I go to tons, or used to go to tons of retro game conventions back when we were allowed to leave the house. Those always have big arcades full of vintage machines in them, but I've still never seen a Street Fighter, and I think the first time I ever actually played the original Street Fighter was in some sort of classic compilation, maybe for PSP. So that would have been, you know, 2004, 2005, 2006, sometime around then. That's almost 20 years after the game actually came out. Maybe I'm forgetting something, but I remember briefly flirting with the DOS version of it because I think this was right before Street Fighter II came to Super NES. And I really wanted to play Street Fighter 2 at home. And there was a DOS port of Street Fighter 1 that was packaged very deceptively. Like it was presented in a way that was clearly biting off Street Fighter 2 to the point that I'm pretty sure, if I'm not misremembering, they had screenshots of the arcade version of... It was either Street Fighter 1 or 2, but I know that the game did not look that good. And I remember thinking, I should get this because it's Street Fighter, but man, I don't know. Should I get this? I feel like this game does not actually look like these screenshots. So I ultimately begged off and waited a few more months and got the Super NES version, and that was the right choice. It was one or the other for me back then, and it would have been heartbreaking to have bought that DOS version and have been stuck with a game that was basically unplayable and absolutely not the one that I wanted. So yeah, that was very deceptive, and I got very, very lucky that my instincts were well-honed enough at that point to make me say, no, don't do that.
If I remember right, that was that the CD that also had Mega Man 1 and 3 DOS on it as well?
I think the version I'm thinking of might have been just diskettes.
Yeah, the one I had, I might still have it somewhere, was on a floppy. And it didn't come with the Mega Man games, which I also wanted, but thank God I did not get.
Yeah, this was... I didn't have a CD-ROM drive until like late 1993, and this was way before that. And when I got a CD-ROM drive for my Macintosh, it was definitely like a leap above anything that my family had for its DOS PC. So it would have been diskettes, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I just remember like a few years later, I found that Street Fighter 2. It was like Street Fighter series CD-ROM, and like I found it was like in the discount bin for $10, and it had that. It's like, this is the only way I've ever seen Street Fighter outside of that one arcade. Begged my mom for it, got it, and it that DOS port and the amount of PC speaker sounds that it had. I woke up my parents just through the loudness of that speaker alone in that game.
I have come across the arcade version a few times in, you know, the past decade or so, like. The Galloping Ghost in Chicago has it. Yeah. I actually saw the version with the pressure buttons when I was in Tokyo back in 2019. We went to the Warehouse Arcade before that closed, and they had it.
I've never been to that. Well, I never went to that one.
It was pretty cool, and that game, I mean, it was the least of all the games they had there, but it was
sure.
very novel trying to use the pressure buttons.
Yeah, I actually, now that I think about it, as many arcades as I've been to in Japan, it's really startling. Like, I've been to Mikado, which is famous for being, you know, a fighting game fanatic retro arcade that's all into like streamed tournaments and stuff, and they didn't have Street Fighter 1 there, so it really is a game that is hard to come by.
It's especially even in Japan, because, I mean, at least we here got the PC ports, but even those compilations, I think those were made mostly for the American audiences. Like, I don't think Japan got those, because I remember reading that the first time they got a real port was the 30th anniversary collection that came out like 2 years ago.
Well, I mean, they got Fighting Street.
Yeah, that counts. Kind of.
I mean, you can't turn your nose up at that. That's the real thing, man. That's legitimate history. Anyway, so basically the point here is Street Fighter 1, not as pervasive as Street Fighter 2. Like, there was a time where you could not escape the presence of Street Fighter 2. That was never the case for Street Fighter 1. And I think most people, myself included, did not know that there was a Street Fighter 1 until Street Fighter 2 came along and said, oh, really? And, you know, for me, I thought, this is the sequel to that NES game? That's weird. So, yeah, it was very kind of messy, and it's really sort of surprising that this game launched the franchise, the empire that it did. But, you know, there are some good ideas within the game, and for its time, 1987, it was pretty ambitious, very, you know, technically advanced, very complex in terms of game mechanics, maybe too complex for what the hardware could handle, but... yeah, you can see where the kind of the kernel of the idea that showed up in that game eventually evolved into something better, which was Street Fighter 2. So to fully understand the history of Street Fighter 1, first, I highly recommend you go to polygon.com and check out the Street Fighter oral history that, you know, by the time this episode comes out, probably will not have been completed. Matt Leone is putting that together. Matt is a former colleague of mine from the 1UP.com days, and his passion is definitely going and digging deep into the history of arcade games. And he does this oral history kind of thing like once every few years. That's his contribution to games journalism. He mostly works behind the scenes, you know, managing stuff. But when he actually steps out of the shadows and puts something together, it's something on the scale of this. This oral history is phenomenal and started with a retrospective on Street Fighter in which he spoke to tons of people, you know, people from Capcom Japan back in the day, people from Capcom USA, people within the fighting scene, you know, people who came to work at Capcom later, you know, folks like Seth Killian, who worked on Street Fighter many years later. It's very comprehensive, very exhaustive, and I'm not going to lie, a lot of kind of the anecdotal stuff that we'll talk about in this episode, I'm sure would not be known if not for Matt's work. So we definitely owe him. You should go check out that episode or that series, and you can also pre-order the printed version of it that is going to be published later this year. I think it's going to cost like $40 for a hardcover. It's going to be hundreds of pages. So I highly recommend it. It's going to be a great piece of video game history. So with that said, the story of Street Fighter begins with a guy named Takashi Nishiyama, also known as Piston Takash in the Street Fighter 1 credits. There is no way to have a conversation about the Street Fighter franchise without talking about Nishiyama. But he actually did not get his start at Capcom. He got his start at IREM in the early 80s, back in the very, like, the golden age of coin-ops. And his games are games that you might not associate with Street Fighter, but you almost definitely have played them or heard of them. If you frequented arcades back in 1982, 83, 84, you saw these games. They were everywhere. They were pretty big. The first of these is Moon Patrol, for which he was the lead designer. It's not a Street Fighter game in the least. It's a shooter, also a platformer, also kind of like an Endless Runner scroller type game. A little bit of Space Invaders to it, but also just kind of its own thing. Have you someone also on the show has spent some time with Moon Patrol? If not Kevin, I mean, surely Kevin at the very least.
Oh, I love Moon Patrol. It's a great game, and I think you kind of get some of the early seeds of what you would get out of Street Fighter, actually, because Moon Patrol is rather ambitious. Like, as you were saying, there's not a whole lot like it at the time. You know, this endless runner sort of thing. You have obstacles, you have enemies that come in and do all sorts of different attacks. Some of them can, like, create new craters that you have to jump over. Like, there's a lot going on there, and it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, like you said, there is a lot to it. You know, the horizontal scroller wasn't a completely new concept before Moon Patrol. You had, you know, Defender, you had Scramble, you had a few games that kind of did this, like, you are basically on this endless scrolling loop. But Moon Patrol was interesting because, you know, in the same way that Zevius sort of redefined the top-down shooter by giving you aerial targets and ground-based targets and different weapons with which to deal with each, and, you know, creating different threats from each type of enemy, Moon Patrol does the same sort of thing, but from a side view. You have, you know, just the ground itself is hazardous. There are craters and pits that can wreck your buggy, which is constantly moving forward. And you can kind of accelerate and decelerate a little bit on the screen, but the screen is scrolling at a constant speed. So you have to manage and pay attention to what the landscape looks like so you don't wreck yourself. But at the same time, while you're doing that, there are aliens and whatever, like, flying around above you, swooping down to attack you and to harass you and to, as Kevin said, to bomb the ground. So you're dealing with hazards kind of on two different levels, and you have a forward gun and an upward gun to kind of deal with things in both directions. But it does demand you kind of split your attention in a way that you didn't see a lot of in arcade games at the time.
And, you know, Street Fighter is all about splitting your attention between different threat options, so.
Yeah, any other thoughts on Moon Patrol from the rest of the crew here?
Not really. I admit, like, Moon Patrol, like, I haven't played a whole lot of myself. I've just mostly seen a lot of footage of it and just kind of, like, seeing the back and forth. But I could see, like, there's a lot of things that I'm seeing a pattern here with Nishiyama's work. We go down the line where just kind of toying with those expectations and diversions like that.
Yeah, I think he's really into sort of complex game design that sort of places a lot of demands on the player, but at the same time gives the player a lot of options, a lot of flexibility in how they can, you know, perform and act. So we see that kind of starting in the form of a scrolling shooter with Moon Patrol, but his next big game is much more in the style of Street Fighter, and that is Kung Fu Master, or if you know it from the NES version, just Kung Fu. And you look at this game and you can really see where Street Fighter came from. So Kung Fu Master, or Kung Fu, it's, you know, like Moon Patrol, it is a scrolling action game. It scrolls forward and backward. It's not auto-scrolling. You have control over the movement. And it is actually based on a Jackie Chan movie. It's called Spartan X in Japan, or Wheels on Meals in America for some reason. And because it is about Jackie Chan, it is therefore a martial combat game. It's really the first belt scroller, the side-scrolling brawler, and it pretty much codifies what you would come to see in the Street Fighter games. You have, you know, different attack options, punches, kicks, jumps, ducking. You basically have kind of the core moveset of Street Fighter right there in this game from 1984. It's kind of impressive.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff with movement, like trying to, like, especially when you're first trying to figure out the game and play through, going through there, trying to figure out what you might start out with. Like, it's like, oh, I can do low kicks, keep get away from the enemy, just like keep them far away from me. But that doesn't work for everything. It's just kind of like a process of learning and going.
It's always so weird the way the enemy attacks work in this game, because they just kind of chop you and then lodge their hand in you, or they're choking you or something like that, and you need to shake them off.
I always thought it was like a nice hug.
Yeah, they just kind of grab onto you, and they like, there's like a hug sandwich too. Like a bunch of them will hug you all at once.
You just wiggle them off and they fall off the screen.
Yeah, it's definitely a game that seems like you're doing really well, and then all of a sudden a bunch of them have latched onto you and all of your life is gone.
I was trying to play the arcade version not too long ago, and that I don't know what it is. Like, I'm so used to the NES version of that game that trying to go to the arcade version, it's just like that. Even the increase in difficulty, I barely got through the first floor.
Yeah, it's a tough game. But again, like Moon Patrol, it gives you a lot of options. It gives you a lot of control abilities. So, you know, even though you are kind of overwhelmed, you still get the sense that Nishiyama has given you the, you know, some critical options to kind of deal with everything and manage everything. And as you get a sense for the rhythm of the game, it does get more manageable. I wouldn't say it ever becomes easy, especially once you get into the part where there's like bees flying at you and dragons falling down from the ceiling. It gets kind of overwhelming, but you know, there's a lot you can do. And for an action game of this vintage, it's very impressive. It feels much more, I guess, solid might be the word, than contemporary fighting type games like ER Kung Fu or Karate Champ from Data East. Like, of all of those kind of early martial arts action games, I would say this one feels the most fluid and the most enjoyable. And I think, you know, it was strong enough a concept that when it came to NES, Nintendo was like, actually, we want to port this ourselves. So, like, the core Nintendo EAD team was responsible for the Kung Fu NES port. And so I think Miyamoto worked on it even. So, you know, to me, that's a sign of quality. I don't think Miyamoto and his team have worked on a lot of games from licensees, but in this was an exception, and they really kind of took to it. And if you remember back in, you know, when the NES first launched, if you're old enough to remember that, this was often the game that you would see on store displays because it just looked so good. It was very vibrant. It had fast-paced action. It had a lot of kind of complexity of control. So it just felt, you know, way, way ahead of most of the rest of the NES launch lineup.
And one thing that strikes me for both Moon Patrol and Kung Fu Master is that you know, if you get overwhelmed and you lose, it never feels like the game was unfair. It feels like it's because of choices you made. And I think that's not something you see too often with arcade games.
No, especially from this era.
Yeah.
I think I was kind of spoiled because when I was a kid, I had a Sega Master System. I didn't think I'd ever say that before. But one of the games that I got
first one
who's
ever said that, yes.
One of the games I got was Black Belt, which I think is definitely a Kung Fu Master clone, but mm-hmm. I think it's a substantially better game just in the way it looks, the way it plays. It was originally a Fist of the North Star game, so when you hit enemies, they explode. But a big note about it is that the boss fights were one-on-one fights, and they played completely differently from the rest of the game. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my introduction to this sort of one-on-one fighting, just those scenes. And they were very unique because there was a puzzle aspect behind them, which, like, you needed to do specific strategies or hit them at specific times if you wanted to do damage. Which, I compared to, like, ER Kung Fu, which is super basic, that game was really ahead of itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing I came across with, like, Kung Fu Master in comparison with like EA or Kung Fu and Karate Champ, it's how good the controls feel in this game. Actually, like when you do a punch, it's both like the sound design and the and just your general movement. You feel like you have a lot more control than in a typical game of this era. So like when you punch a bad guy and they fall off the screen, it just feels good.
Oh yeah, I do like the way everyone kind of falls off the screen when you punch them. It is there's a certain charm to it.
Yeah, there's a joy.
It feels like a stage play at that mm-hmm. point. Like you're just knocking the bad actors right off.
So after putting together Kung Fu Master for iRim, Nishiyama left iRim and joined Capcom, which, you know, is a thing that was not done. Although it does seem like there was a lot of talent shuffling back and forth, like Tokuro Fujiwara leaving Konami to go to Capcom. So I guess Capcom was just like, you know, not shy about poaching people. Of course, Capcom was pretty new at this time. The company was established in 1983. I don't think they published their first game until 84. So it was basically like, hey, come join us. We're the new hotness or something. In any case, Nishiyama joined Capcom and went right to work designing games. And the first two games he designed there were also games that showed up on NES. Section Z, or Section Z, I guess, if you prefer, Zetto, and Trojan, or... I can't even remember what the Japanese title is. It's the Battle of something.
Tatsukai no Banka, I think.
Yeah,
something like that.
But what does that mean? Tatsukai is a fight? No, I don't know. Anyway.
I had it written down, but...
It's fine. So Section Z, I would say, is an evolution of Moon Patrol, in a sense, in that it is an auto-scrolling shooter, but instead of being restricted to the ground, you are a little dude with a jetpack. And the complexity here is not that you can shoot forward and up, it's that you can shoot forward or backward. And unfortunately, the arcade game is not that fun because to shoot backward or change direction, there's a separate button that you have to press that will cause your little guy to rotate. And it's very cumbersome to like be firing and then have to press another button to turn around and shoot something behind you. The NES version streamlined this so A shoots forward and B shoots backward, and it's a much better approach. But Section Z is, you know, it's interesting, but I think a little kind of cumbersome in the arcade incarnation. But, you know, definitely that element of complexity that you see, you know, in all of Nishiyama's work.
I've never actually played the arcade version. Like, I've seen other people play it in the arcade, and it was really popular when there were arcades to go to, but yeah, never tried it myself.
I did not know that it was very popular. I remember someone telling me once when the NES version came out that they had seen the arcade version, and it was really weird. And having played it many, many years later, I agree. It was kind of weird.
Well, okay. I'll caveat that. It was popular in the arcade I went to.
Okay. There we go. Trojan, on the other hand, really does feel like the next step of Kung Fu Master. It is another, you know, kind of belt scroller where you have high and low attacks. But instead of just being a martial artist, you are basically a post-apocalyptic warrior with a sword and shield. And so you can attack high and low, and you can also block high and low. And the arcade game, I think, also is not as familiar to most people as the NES game. And it feels a little weird because some of the mechanics are a bit different, and some of the elements, like there's these like spring pads that'll launch you into the air so you can stab guys in high buildings while you're near them. It's a little strange, but the basic concept comes through. I don't know if anyone else has thoughts on Trojan.
I also remember being super impressed that there was a whole button dedicated to blocking.
Oh yeah. Again, we're seeing that kind of line here where like it's kind of like turning games on its edge a little bit, just trying, like, there's a button for block. There's just different from the normal style of platformers, like all these games so far.
Yeah, so blocking is a big part of Trojan, and to the point that if you block the wrong attack instead of dodging it, you will actually lose your sword and shield. They'll be knocked away from you, and you'll have to scramble to go get them. I think like the little goblin, like green goblin looking dudes who jump around and throw spikes at you, I think the little bombs they throw can knock away your sword and shield. I think there's also a barbarian that swings a club, and that'll knock away your sword and shield. So the idea here is Kung Fu did not have blocking. Trojan has blocking, but it's, you know, like this kind of limited function external to your character and has to be kind of managed. And then you get to Street Fighter, and blocking is a key part of that game. So, yeah, Trojan was 1985-86, and Street Fighter came 1987. The game debuted in the summer of 1987 and is a direct line. There's a direct line from Kung Fu Master because Nishiyama says he was inspired by the boss fights in Kung Fu Master where the screen stops and it's just Thomas versus like a dude in a wife beater or just some imposing guy with like a baseball bat or 2x4 or whatever. I guess, you know, the idea is that it's you against kind of overwhelming odds and you really have to manage it. So Street Fighter takes those parts of Kung Fu Master and throws out all the scrolling parts. So it's just you and another character. And it comes down to like how well you can manage space and launch attacks and defend yourself.
Right. Yeah. Forget all these goons. Just get to the heart of the matter. Just get to the main baddie, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, never really thought about that. But yeah, fighting games are basically a boss rush.
Mm-hmm. And Nishiyama says the concept came to him while he was bored in a staff meeting, as so many great ideas do. He just started like doodling the idea of having, you know, the boss fight video game. And he took that to Yoshiki Okamoto, the guy who was running Capcom's game division. He was the guy behind stuff like 1942 and 43. And Okamoto was like, yeah, that's cool. I like this. So Nishiyama created a whole pitch for it. And Capcom said, yeah, why not? Go for it. Kind of seems like their arcade division in those days was pretty open. Like if you came up with an idea and everyone thought, oh, this is good, let's like just go for it. So Nishiyama got together with Hiroshi Matsumoto, who was the planner on the game, and they started designing it. And it just happened that Matsumoto was a huge martial arts fan, so that had a huge influence on how the game was designed. I see someone also made a note about the music here. No?
Oh, yeah, that was me.
Okay.
Yeah. the music I don't think is particularly good, but, you know, Yuki-chan's papa is a popular Mega Man composer, so...
Yeah, the thing you need to understand about Capcom in 1986-87 is that the company was actually very small. Like there was not much of a company at this point. It was, you know, I don't know exactly how big it was, but I get the impression it was like a dozen people kind of working on the games and then whatever management you had. So you have Keiji Inafune, the kind of the character designer and later producer for Mega Man, working on it. You had Okamoto sort of overseeing it. I think Okamoto, if I'm remembering right, I just was talking about this in a video recently, was the guy who created Black Tiger right around the same time. So that was kind of the opposite of Street Fighter in the sense that your character was much smaller and it was all about kind of arming yourself and taking on tons and tons of little Zako type enemies, you know, just little riffraff, trying to work your way to the boss and build up your power. But it also had like really detailed, rich graphics and that great FM synthesis sound. So Capcom, you know, even though there were kind of like three or four sort of creative leads at the time, Tokoro Fujiwara of Ghosts and Goblins was the other, you know, they were all kind of working at this sort of high level in terms of graphical output, in terms of clever, inventive takes on developing game concepts. And Street Fighter was just sort of the, like, you know, martial arts combat, the belt scroller turned into a boss fight take on that. And, you know, visually and aesthetically, it really fits in with Capcom's contemporary work.
Yeah. One cool thing is if you go through the Street Fighter 30th Anniversary Collection and go through the History Museum, which is totally worth it just for that alone, by the way, you can see the whole original. It's in Japanese, but you can read the whole original Street Fighter pitch document.
I have not done that. I should.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot for Street Fighter 1 because, understandably, Street Fighter 2 made a little bit bigger waves, but it's worth going through just to see some of the information behind that.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, the pitch document for Street Fighter 1 was also much smaller just because, you know, 1987 versus 1991, those were two very different eras of video game design. You know, it was effectively, not really in terms of arcades, but effectively 8-bit versus 16-bit. So, you know, I think at that point, 1987, it was kind of the final days of being able to just say like, hey, I've got a bunch of ideas, let's throw them on paper and put them into a video game. Whereas after this, you really started needing to do more meticulous planning and more careful consideration of balance. Because, you know, there's not really much balance in Street Fighter One. It's not a fair game. It's not even really a fun game, but it's very inventive and has a lot of really cool ideas. I think one of the most essential ideas, you know, I think you can make a case for several core ideas being the most essential in Street Fighter. But one of the defining elements, I think, came from Matsumoto working with Nishiyama. And that is the way they didn't just make this a game about a single martial art. You know, you had Karate Champ, which was about karate fighting and was like very technical, you know, landing blows and using official Olympic style judging for Karate Champ. In Street Fighter, you have two guys who do karate. They are the playable characters, Ryu and Ken. But then everyone else uses different forms of martial arts. And you travel around the world to like four or five different countries, and you fight two people in each country. And each of those characters has their own fighting style. Aside from the final two, you fight in Thailand. They're both Muay Thai, different kind of takes on Muay Thai, but you know, they're pretty similar. It's basically like the hard Muay Thai and then the really, really hard Muay Thai. but otherwise, you have, you know, everything from like a completely ridiculous ninja whose skills are not based in reality in any way, to someone who's using like traditional stick fighting, to a Kenpo master. So there are a lot of martial arts styles mixed in here, and, you know, somewhat accurate considering the limitations of the platform. So that's a pretty impressive element. And, you know, I think that sort of different blend of styles lent itself to having characters who were more distinct from one another than you often saw in video games. It wasn't just that the characters looked different from one another, but they also moved differently. They behaved differently. They fought differently. So there was this sense of distinction. You know, each character had their own name. And with that name came a sense of like, you know, this is the guy I'm going to have a really hard time against, because I just can't get my head around the way he manages space, or the way he uses this one attack, or the way he always seems to evade my special attack or whatever. So, you know, it creates, I don't know, like a sort of trademark element to me of Street Fighter is that everyone kind of has their own preference of who to play. And that's not really the case here. But I think, you know, the kind of character you gravitate toward reflects kind of your personality and your approach to the game. And it also kind of indicates what kind of opponent you're going to have a difficult time against. So like with Street Fighter II, I've always gravitated toward Chun-Li because of her mobility and, you know, the way she can dodge out of attacks pretty easily. But she's really vulnerable to anti-air players. So, you know, to me, that's always been kind of the hard thing that I've had to balance is the fact that, you know, when I go up against a character that uses a lot of aerial attacks, that's going to be really, or anti-air attacks, that's going to be tough for me. And you kind of see that taking shape here.
Yeah, one thing that before you even get into the fight, you're introduced to a character portrait of that, just a highly detailed portrait of that character you're about to fight. And there's not a, like, it just, you're already injecting a little bit of personality of like, oh, this guy looks like a boxer. This, like, what sort of, we're already getting like a little introduction of that character and how they fight. So we already see them a little bit more than we see in like Karate Champ, where they're just another opponent. You know, like who cares?
Yeah, they get a little bit of personality. Like, I mean, they obviously don't get a backstory in this game, but you get a look at their face up close, and then you get a picture of their sprite and their stage, which also like communicates a bit about what their deal is. And you know, it kind of works. I mean, in conjunction with their special moves and their fighting style, you kind of get a sense like, oh, you know, Retsu is super cool. Yeah, they should do more with him.
It's like, whoa, Geki has a claw. Whoa.
This game definitely looked really good in stills. As, I mean, video game magazines at the time put a lot of pictures of the TurboGrafx-16 port, And like the introduction scene looks really, really cool with the guy bashing through the wall or the details put in the stages. It's just when you actually see the game in motion that it's not great.
Yeah, it's pretty choppy, but you have to keep bear in mind this is 1987. This was a fairly early Capcom arcade board. It was, you know, before CPS1. So it definitely had limitations. You know, another thing about this game is that when you talk about fighting games, like hitboxes and collision detection are super important. In this game, hit detection in this game sucks. It's really bad. Like your hitboxes
are somewhere.
Yeah, it's basically like draw a big rectangle that encompasses the entire character, and that is where they are vulnerable.
And even then, like sometimes you throw like a hot oaken and it just goes through the character because they're too close.
Yeah, it's not a forgiving game. It's definitely stacked against the player. But, you know, I think the fact that you're constantly facing off against different opponents also adds to the complexity because, again, every character has their own style. Every character has a different sort of physical presence, too. So, you know, like Joe, the guy you face first, the kickboxer, MMA guy from the USA, he's just kind of vanilla. He's just like this dude who's there. He's pretty easy to beat compared to everyone else. But then you get to Mike the boxer, and he's much more aggressive, really gets in your face. Whereas, you know, a few fights later, you fight Geki, the ninja, and he's almost impossible to hit because he constantly uses this, like, vanishing smoke, and he just disappears. You'll launch an attack at him and he'll just disappear before it lands, and then he'll reappear somewhere and throw a shuriken at you that you basically can't dodge. So, you know, it gets really challenging. Birdie, on the other hand, is huge, so he's very physically intimidating. And the thing about Birdie is he moves kind of slowly, but his kind of trademark attack is that he just makes this really quick short dash at you, so you have to kind of keep your distance. Otherwise, you know, you have to kind of duck in to take a hit and then duck back. Otherwise, he's just going to barrel over you with his little quick feint strikes.
Yeah, hits like a truck, too.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Edon, the next to final guy, the first Muay Thai master you fight, he's very intimidating because he has so much movement to him. He's like standing on one foot and basically like three of his limbs are ready to strike you at the same, like that's, it's really intimidating to have a dude who's not just, he doesn't just have his dukes up, he also has one leg up to kick you, and he's very quick, and you know, it's a very, very intimidating fight if you can even make it that far. And then Sagat is basically the same thing, except, you know, like half the size of the screen, and also he has projectiles, which, you know, other than Geki, you don't really see a lot of in this game. So yeah. There's kind of like this elevating level of complexity with each of these fighters.
And I think that's a good thing to note, that special moves in this game really hurt. Like they hit hard, even yours, if you can actually pull them off.
They were really supposed to be like secret moves. Like today we think of special moves as being like an essential part of the fighting game experience, but they were almost like cheats if you could pull them off.
Yeah, you can win in one dragon punch uppercut if you like land it properly. Just, you know, good luck getting it to come out when you need
like
it.
Can you actually land it properly? No, you can't.
I've never pulled off a dragon punch in this game. I don't know what the
there's a little bit of a trick to it where kind of like in Street Fighter 2, there's a way you, like if you hold down the button beforehand, you do it's called negative edge, where if you do the motion and let go of the button on button up, it makes it way easier to do. But yeah, even then it feels like a huge risk, especially if you're fight like in the middle of a fight and just low on life and you're risking it all at that point.
And the game's detection for your motion for the special move is just like so strict that functionally, the only way I've ever been able to do them semi-consistently is just to mash. And, you know, every third mash will be a fireball or a dragon punch, whether or not I want one or the other.
Yeah, we've seen follow-ups to Street Fighter kind of try to balance out ease of pulling off special maneuvers versus actually making the game challenging. And this game kind of exists at the opposite end of the spectrum of something like Marvel versus Capcom, which is just like, every action you take is a special move. Oh my God, you're just filling the screen with all kinds of crazy stuff, and nothing really does that much damage because it's so over the top and it's balanced to be just like, you know, a constant stream of like super fireballs and stuff. Whereas here, yeah, the secret maneuvers, the secret moves were there more for expert play. And it was basically like you would play and be like, wow, how come I can only punch and kick a dude and they can throw shuriken at me and they can use like, you know, long range striking attacks with sticks and things like that. I don't have anything like that. So the idea was to kind of come across those maybe by mistake as you played and think, wow, how did I do that? I need to keep pulling that off. So it was definitely a game that was meant to be, there's meant to be an element of discovery to it for sure.
I could definitely see in like, if Street Fighter, like in the arcade where you're playing like one versus the other, like you see someone else throwing a fireball out there. It's like, whoa, how'd you do that? And they just like, it's like, maybe they wouldn't tell you just because they want the upper advantage on you. Like they have information you do not have.
Yeah, I think Midway really mastered that with the fatalities and stuff and, you know, the additional allities in the Mortal Kombat games, because those really were a matter of like, oh, I figured it out. I'm the king of the arcade now. I can do all the cool finishing moves. And, you know, whoever could do those before the magazines started publishing them, they were awesome. They were like the guys you wanted to watch fight. Or the girls you wanted to watch fight, because they were going to just wreck everyone and look really cool doing it. This was kind of the start of that, but done very inelegantly and not in a way that made you think, oh, this is so good. I love this. It's very satisfying. No, it really wasn't.
Inelegant describes Street Fighter 1 very well. Just, you know, even the movement around the screen is very like janky, jumping. Just, you know, it looks like a stop of like a flip book.
Yeah, it's like a very, very triangular jump motion.
Yeah. But you can tell that, you know, special moves are a big deal if you manage to pull them off. Not only do they hit really hard, but when you land a fireball against someone or a Hadouken, like the action kind of slows down. There's the kind of the slow motion element. And it's not because the computer is like, how do I process, you know, this extra frame of animation of someone taking a hit. It's a deliberate slowdown to give you the impression that, oh, I just did something really important. This matters. So there were these kind of built-in elements to it, but it's still, again, yeah, inelegant is the way to describe it. But you have to admire just the variety and the flexibility within the core control set. Because, you know, this took the Kung Fu Master standard and really expanded it. You had high attacks, you had low attacks, so standing, crouching, and then jumping attacks. So that's three different levels in which you could attack. You could attack with either kicks or punches. So you have three attacks times two, and then you had the strength of your attack, a strong, a medium, or a light attack. So that's, you know, three attacks, two variants with three different power levels. So that's basically 18 attacks by default. And then, you know, depending on which direction you press the controller in, you're ducking, you're jumping, you're blocking, you're reversing, you're closing in on the opponent. So there's a lot of things you can be doing at any given moment. And, you know, the game doesn't execute those as smoothly as it should, certainly. But, you know, considering all that this game was doing, it's pretty impressive. And the original idea was for all the characters to be playable. But I think there was just so much going on and such a, you know, ultimately a time crunch to churn out this arcade game that they just went with Ryu and Ken, who are basically more or less the same character, but with different colors.
Right. And even Ryu and Ken are both on like one player or two player side. They're just locked to that side altogether. So if you want to pick Ken, you gotta go up on the two player side.
Yeah, I think it should be noted that unlike a lot of later fighting games, you don't really just smoothly walk left and right. You just do these little tiny hops, and you can get blasted in the face really easily while you're doing your little hops to close in. So
it feels like there's a delay after every motion. Like it doesn't, it's not as smooth as it should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I kind of get to, in my head, like those Tiger Electronic LCD games, like just like suddenly move over to the next spot, essentially.
Right. Yeah, still a lot of things they were trying to get right, and they would improve for the sequel. But here, I mean, you can actually see improvements happening on the fly with Street Fighter, because the original arcade cabinet is sort of infamous. It was co-designed by Atari Games. So, you know, the game was developed in Japan, but the cabinet was actually made by an American company. A designer named Ken Hata designed the game from Atari, and it was pretty wild. I've never actually seen a cabinet in person, but Kevin or maybe John, someone who actually has had, you know, physical contact with this, tell us about it, because it seems like it's really huge and really uniquely designed.
So the one I played, I don't remember if it was the full crescent shape design or if it just had the pressure buttons, but that's sort of the key component of it, is that the idea was to do your, you know, three levels of strength. You had these two giant pneumatic punch and kick buttons on each side, and the harder you hit them, the stronger the attack would be. And, you know, they were covered in rubber for, you know, some semblance of, you know, survivability in an arcade. In practice, they work really poorly because it's exhausting. Like, even after one round, your arms are half dead. And good luck trying to do special moves in conjunction with those things, because they are heavy and they are slow to move. It was an interesting concept. I understand why they did it, because, you know, Sega and Namco were making big money off of these specialist cabinets. This was not it.
Well, it's kind of forward thinking of it, like Capcom to think it's like, oh, we should get Atari Games in on this, because Atari Games had a lot of unique and weird cabinets that like they almost kind of excelled at that, like with the like 720 and Paperboy and a bunch of all these unique cabinets that strike out to the to a player who's just wandering through the arcade. I definitely, from what I can see of the original crescent shape design, that is, it's a big, sturdy cabinet with these weird, huge buttons. And I could see myself going like, what is that? What is that?
And then you'd play it once and then you'd say, okay, well, that was cool, I guess. I will add that all of the Atari games, like coin-op papers, are at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, and they do have all the documents on the design of the Street Fighter cabinet. So if you're up that way, you know, feel free to check it out.
Namco had actually put out something similar. It wasn't a fighting game, but Bravo Man a side-scrolling game. And it also had two pressure-sensitive buttons. I don't think they were as big as the Street Fighter ones, but the idea is the harder you press down, the more powerful the attack would be, or the higher you jump. And it ran into that same issue where it just broke way too often for it to be any good.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a decade later, more than a decade later, Capcom would revisit this concept a little bit and get it right with, along with SNK on Neo Geo Pocket Color, where the fighting games, you know, you had SNK style fighters and Capcom style fighters on this system with two face buttons. But instead of it being pressure sensitive, instead of, you know, recognizing the pressure and force you used, instead, it was basically how long you held down the attack button would determine the power of the attack. So if you just tapped, you'd do a light strike. But if you held it down for a moment, then you would get a full, strong, you know, forward kick or whatever. So the concept isn't bad. It was just the execution really wasn't built around the needs of arcade play, because, you know, one of the designers or the Capcom arcade representatives that were interviewed for Polygon said, you know, what you want from an arcade game is for someone to really get addicted and just keep dropping quarters in it. But when this game came out, we had a launch party with a bunch of MMA dudes, like boxers and stuff. These like hardened fighters and athletes, and they were getting exhausted from playing a single round. So, you know, if this game is tiring you out, you're not going to want to keep dropping quarters into it. So in that sense, it was a failure. And, you know, also because it had this kind of custom pneumatic design where, according to some notes someone added, if a button was defective, the entire control panel had to be repaired, sent off for repairs. That's not... You don't want that in an arcade. That's putting, you know, this moneymaker out of commission for weeks. So that's really bad.
Yeah, it's not like you can replace it with another arcade, like another board in the meantime.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, especially an American arcade where, you know, the arcade goers were notoriously much harder on the machines than they are in Japanese arcades. Like, I'd be surprised if any of these cabinets lasted a week.
The rumor I always heard was like people trying to drop kick the machine just to get the strongest attack out. I don't know how much truth there is to that, but that's all what I've always heard with this game.
I feel like that would be a difficult way to play, but what do I know?
Yeah, it's not surprising that very shortly they started producing standard cabinets with a 6-button panel, which was also pretty unusual at the time since... how many arcade games in 1987 or even in the 90s had that many buttons, but Street Fighter kind of paved that way.
Yeah.
Way more reliable.
If you look back, you can see some of the early kind of before joysticks were the standard control mechanism, you had games like Asteroids or Defender or whatever that had a lot of buttons to deal with on the control panel, but they didn't also have a joystick. Whereas this was, you know, you had an 8-direction joystick plus 6 buttons. So that's a little overwhelming. But yeah, you just like the pneumatic design just was not the way to go. So... a noble effort, but one that was just not suited for the realities of arcade gaming. And, you know, another element of Street Fighter that was almost but not quite successful.
It is interesting that they did go to that 6-button format, though, because, you didn't see that in the arcade already. And it seemed like they had to fight the Capcom sales market team to convince them that people will understand 6 buttons. And that became a commonplace for the Street Fighter series going forward. They kept that happening.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this game's legacy is that even the people who worked at Capcom and spoke to Polygon don't seem to know how successful it was. Like, different people were throwing out numbers ranging from like 1,500 units sold, which would have been a disaster, to 50,000 units sold, which would have been like, you know, Pac-Man level success. It's like Donkey Kong right there. It's massive. So there's really, weirdly, there's just not a sense within, you know, for the people who were there at the company at the time of just how effectively this game sold and how widespread it was. They said something about there being a lot of bootleg boards. So maybe the official sales were actually pretty low, but it achieved, you know, pretty decent penetration into the market just through bootlegs. But it's hard to say. But in any case, the concept of Street Fighter kind of lay fallow for a few years until Street Fighter II. But, you know, it's had a legacy that's, I you know, even beyond Street Fighter II, like, Capcom does go back to this game, even with Street Fighter V, and look back and say, oh, this is an element from the original Street Fighter. We need to kind of bring it back and, you know, canonize it a little bit. So that's cool that it has that element to it. So just about every character in this game has shown up in some capacity Except maybe Joe. I don't think anyone cares about Joe. Has Joe shown up? Is he the guy who gets his face punched in the attract mode of Street Fighter 2?
That was the rumor.
Supposedly. Yeah, I think only, I think Lee, Geki, Retsu, and I guess maybe Mike are the ones that never have returned. Although Mike, there's people who for a long time assumed that Balrog or, you know, M. Bison in Japan was supposed to be Mike.
I mean, it would make sense. It was clearly Mike Tyson, Mike Bison, you know, a boxer from America. For some reason, fighting in front of Mount Rushmore. But no, that's not the case, apparently. Totally coincidental that there are two Mikes who box in America. You wouldn't think that would be the case.
There's a there like one of the Street Fighter V arcade mode endings for Balrog. He's dreaming that like he dreams of Mike winning the Street Fighter Champion circuit, and he's like, wait a minute, that wasn't me. So they at least address it in some way.
But I think, is it Street Fighter V that canonized the fact that I want to say, crap, I should have looked this up. I know that basically Chun-Li has mentioned, I think, Retsu as like her sensei or something. And the ninja characters like Ibuki have referenced Geki. So
that sounds right.
Yeah. So even if the characters haven't shown up as fighting characters again, they have still been referenced.
They're in the lore.
Right.
Yeah, nearly everything in the Street Fighter universe is kind of cyclic, except for the NES title we're going to talk about in a little bit.
So. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, immediately, Ryu and Ken and Sagat showed up in Street Fighter 2. Birdie and Gen and Adon, and I think also Eagle, right, showed up in Street Fighter Alpha games.
Eventually, Eagle.
Yeah, Eagle showed up in like some of the ports of Alpha 3.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay.
But he showed up originally and it was just a random, like he was randomly added in Capcom versus SNK2. And that was just a nice little, it's like, oh, it was a surprise.
Boy, a friend of mine in high school was so hyped up when he heard that they were adding Eagle to CVS2.
So basically, Capcom has continued to keep this game alive, even though they don't really necessarily go back to it a lot. But, you know, it did show up on as a bad DOS port. And there was, you know, kind of the famous PC Engine CD-ROM-ROM game, which was Fighting Street for some reason, not Street Fighter. But it was this game, and it was one of the very first CD-ROM games ever made. I think there were three games at the launch of that platform, and this was one of them. So it does have that distinction. I don't really know why they needed a CD-ROM for this particular game.
It's got a pretty good soundtrack.
Yeah, but it was still chiptunes.
You got the voice samples.
Oh, yeah.
It does. The voice samples are all synthesized, though. Like, you figured they would have gotten someone to, like, record the lines.
I mean, given that it was 1989 or thereabouts for the CD-ROM, it probably would have more likely been in someone's office bathroom, but
would have been impressive.
Are the voices in the arcade game synthesized?
Yeah, they are too.
Okay.
At least like the, you know, the post-battle ones.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's always just like the guy saying the same thing, like, there are more people like you in the world. So that would explain why the intonation is so weird. Okay, that explains a lot.
Yeah, I think they just copied all the audio from the arcade to the CD-ROM for the PC Engine, which, you know, that's fine.
Yeah, it just sounds a little bit more, it already sounded a little bit garbled, that synthesized voice, but it sounds especially garbled in Fighting Street, where thank goodness for the text with it.
Right, yeah, if it weren't for the text, you'd be like, what the hell is being said here?
Like, sir, this is a Wendy's.
And, you know, there were a couple other computer ports, like the Commodore 64 got two different ones, one for Europe and one for the U.S. There's like a ZX Spectrum port.
Let me guess, the European one is, it plays a little worse, but it has a better soundtrack?
You know, the U.S. Commodore 64 one has a pretty decent soundtrack, and it has special moves. None of the European ones apparently do, which seems like a massive oversight.
Yeah, it's kind of a big part of the game.
And, you know, I don't have a huge amount of experience with those versions of it. I've played a little bit of the Commodore 64 one. It's fine. It's probably the best you can say about any version of Street Fighter, is that it's fine.
Right. Yeah, and arcade ports have shown up on several Capcom compilations through the years, so it's not too hard to find, you know, track down, find, and play some version of this game. I think it might be supported on Mr. Now also. I can't remember, but I believe it is.
And I guess Capcom was planning an NES port. That never really made it off the ground, but there are a couple screenshots included on the 30th anniversary collection. So
imagine how terrible that would have been.
Oh, God.
It, from what I could tell, it looks similar to the MS, the DOS port a little bit, but it's, it, yeah.
You know,
the characters are tiny. I mean, they were only so big that they could make them. I mean, the Master System was able to pull off something like the Black Belt 2D scenes, but I don't know about the Nintendo.
I mean, the soundtrack probably would have been decent.
It's weird. At the time, like, I know Capcom made arcade games, but I knew almost all their stuff through home ports. So when you hear something like that, like Black Tiger was another one that I guess there was a home port in the work that ended up getting canceled, mm-hmm. but I feel like people would know a lot more if it got an NES version.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. That's definitely one of those that I think its legacy has suffered for not having a home port. Because it's a pretty cool little game. But this isn't about that game. This is about Street Fighter. So I see someone added some notes about Nishiyama leaving Capcom after this game. I think, you know, the fact that the creator of this game left the company to join the competition maybe had something to do with the fact, or, you know, accounts for the fact that we didn't see a direct follow-up to this game for so long. So whoever added that, could you walk us through the tale of Nishiyama? Oh, did I write that?
I think we all contributed. I
don't remember
started it.
Yeah, I don't remember writing this, but
no.
Okay, and I think it was late at night. Okay, I might have put the part about Nishiyama, but someone else added a lot about Fatal Fury. So I will say, yeah, Nishiyama left Capcom after Street Fighter. He joined the competition at SNK. That was, you know, I talked about Capcom poaching, but apparently there was like this big thing between Capcom and SNK at the time. Capcom poached, I want to say, Manami Matsumae from them, the composer.
I think it was Harumi Fujita.
Oh, maybe, yeah, Harumi Fujita. That's right. She's like the boss of Capcom's music back then. So that was a big, you know, a big loss for SNK. So supposedly in retaliation, they poached Nishiyama, but Nishiyama has said, you know, again, in that Polygon retrospective, that the oral history, that basically his games kind of underperformed, and Okamoto was a very sort of numbers, metrics-driven type guy, and so they didn't get along very well. Okamoto was apparently pretty harsh on him. So when he left Capcom, it was less about, like, SNK taking revenge and more like Nishiyama wanting some place where he could, you know, create innovative, interesting games that weren't necessarily going to sell gangbusters. And that seems to be kind of SNK's whole thing. Like, let's do something creative and cool, but who cares if it's a hit?
And then, you know, they managed to become a hit despite all that.
Right. Thanks to Nishiyama.
America. Yeah. So, you know, I could talk a little about Fatal Fury since I'm the one who added all
okay,
that
thank you.
Stuff in.
I know I didn't write that because I know nothing.
So basically, you know, when Nishiyama left, he also took some of the Street Fighter 1 team members with him. And when they went to SNK and they started working on sort of a spiritual successor to Street Fighter. And that became Fatal Fury. And if you play Street Fighter and then you try Fatal Fury, it's really obvious that these two games came from, like, the same people, because, you know, in Fatal Fury, you're starting out, you're picking one of three characters, and then you pick your first opponent, sort of like you do in Street Fighter. All the opponents have their own special moves. You can't pick any of them yourself. And there's sort of, like, this emphasis on a story mode. Like, it's, I don't even think you can necessarily, you know, play against each other. Like, if you have someone else jump in, you just double team the computer opponent. And then I think you fight over who gets to stay on the machine. The special moves also do a ton of damage in this game, just like in Street Fighter. They're marginally easier to pull off. It's just very fascinating to me, because Fatal Fury came out almost the same time Street Fighter 2 did, and that was led by Okamoto, I believe. And, you know, they both took different core aspects of the original Street Fighter game and sort of ran with them in these different directions. So, in a sense, the two games are, you know, siblings, sort of taking the, I won't say the best aspects of the original game, because I think Street Fighter 2 got most of them, but they take aspects from the original game. And I guess you could say the single player focus from Fatal Fury and Street Fighter is sort of the predecessor to, you know, the elaborate arcade modes you got in, you know, later SNK games like King of Fighters and, you know, modern games like Mortal Kombat.
I remember, like, these came out roughly-ish the same time, but I definitely remember playing Street Fighter 2 long before I ever saw Fatal Fury, and I had long gotten the impression that Fatal Fury was just a ripoff of Street Fighter 2, which the development doesn't quite add up, but I felt like in America, that's kind of like how people perceive the difference between Capcom and SNK. Like, Capcom was the one making the big strides and SNK was the one playing follow-up, and I don't think that was the same way in Japan.
Yeah, I think there was more of a delay getting Fatal Fury to the U.S. just because the Neo Geo board that it runs on had more of a rollout.
I also remember the home ports, because the home ports of Street Fighter 2 are pretty good, and the Genesis port of Fatal Fury was not.
Yeah, none of those, not none of them, but a lot of those early SNK ports are dire.
It does seem to kind of play around with Nishiyama's wanting to continue playing around with, like, little bits and pieces, like the two-lane system that's in Fatal Fury, for example. It's like, well, what if there was, like two, like, where you can go back and forth? Did Fatal Fury 1 have that, or was that a later one? I can't remember.
Fatal Fury 1 does have it.
Okay, doesn't that one actually have three planes?
No, I don't think so. I was just playing it earlier.
I always thought that was in place because of the co-op. Like, you kind of needed that extra little bit of space to have so many large characters. But even after they got rid of the co-op, they still kept the two planes for quite a while.
Yeah, right up to one of the Real Bout games, if I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Real Bout 2 just throws that all away.
All right, so Nishiyama went to SNK, made a Street Fighter killer, and Capcom kind of shuffled its feet for a while. Like, clearly, Street Fighter 1 did okay for them because they didn't just throw out the brand. In fact, they were trying to figure out what the hell to do with it. And it took them a while. Initially, there was going to be a game called Street Fighter 89. But then that turned out to be called Final Fight instead, and was very successful, being sort of unmoored from Street Fighter for a decade until they started to fold it back. Well, not even quite a decade, but, you know, they started to fold it back in with Street Fighter Alpha 2, I believe, and said, oh, yes, there are connections between these video game worlds. And then there is the other game we're going to talk about this episode briefly, which isn't really anything to do with Street Fighter at all. But it is interesting because it is branded as, like, both Street Fighter and Final Fight. And that is Street Fighter 2010 The Final Fight, which in Japan was just called 2010 Street Fighter and did not have any characters involved from Street Fighter whatsoever. But in America, they were like, well, this guy's named Kevin in Japan. If we took out the V and the I, then he's Ken. And there is a guy in Street Fighter named Ken. So this is now the future version of Ken, maybe. And he's using his special fighting moves with cybernetics. He's been out of the fighting circuit. What does it say? It's been 25 years since Ken was the king of the Street Fighter circuit. But that's nothing some good bionics can't fix.
I also like the idea that Ken, you know, who would go on to be, you know, this rich playboy, is apparently a world-class scientist.
He's not a playboy. He's a family man. He's got a wife and a kid
that we know about. I mean,
don't disparage Ken.
He might be living a double or a triple life. No.
I just like the idea
Ken
that
Ken is a good guy.
I like the idea that it's like Ken wins the Street Fighter tournament. It's like, you know what? I think I'm just going to go home and be a scientist. That cool? See you guys.
Finally, I can pay my university tuition in America. Now that I'm rich from street fighting.
I'd like to see a Street Fighter 6 where they, Ken's wife Eliza finds out that she's cheating on him, so she hops into the tournament as a playable character to beat him up.
What's with this obsession with infidelity? It's just not, that's not Ken. Come on. Anyway, this also is not Ken, the Street Fighter character. I don't know who he is, but basically this is a game that, I mean, I can almost kind of see where they sort of got the connection. This is very much like the sci-fi cool dude game genre of the NES, along with like Vice Project Doom, Power Blade, that kind of thing. But it's not, your typical side-scrolling platformer. It's not your typical action game at all. It's very much based around boss fights. You're hunting bounties as this futuristic version of Ken with cybernetics. And, you're not using like a full suite of Street Fighter maneuvers, but you do have a lot of kind of grappling and physical skills. You can grab onto overhead racks or like lines, cables and stuff, and then swing yourself up. You've got like a punch attack that shoots a beam. It's kind of weird, but yeah, it is really about these kind of one-on-one fights against these various bounties that you're fighting. But because it takes place in the future, you're not traveling around the world to fight other martial artists. You're traveling around like the galaxy to fight weird monsters and stuff. It's so strange. Now, they take place on different planets, including Tatooine and Dagobah. Like, it's not even subtle. Come on.
Yeah, I think there's, I was looking in the background of the, I think the second area you're in, and like there's something that looks straight up like a Jawa. So
it's so close to being like a pretty cool game. Like, there's a lot of interesting ideas in this, and like the original Street Fighter, I don't think they really nail any of them. So maybe that's how it fits into the whole legacy.
A good idea, but it flopped.
The controls are so weird in this game because you have like the forward punch. If you want to, you can attack straight upwards, but you can attack upward at an angle by holding down. The game,
it's like a kickball.
Yeah. And I mean, it desperately needed like some sort of low attack because right at the beginning of the game, trying to get those rockets that get at you, they're always like just below the range of your mean punching ability. So it's so difficult. You have to like maneuver until you can get on their level and hit them. Maybe they were operating by Mega Man rules. They're like, our heroes just can't duck. but that sort of peculiarity makes it very difficult to play. Like, I remember renting this game when I was a kid, and I knew it wasn't like an actual port of Street Fighter 2, but because the title, like, it lies twice because it implies it's Street Fighter or Final Fight, and it's none of those things. And I don't think I ever got past the first level.
Yeah, Oh, sorry, go on.
Even with the tenacity of like an 11-year-old kid, I just couldn't do it.
Yeah, I love how it just doubles down on that. It's like, okay, it's Street Fighter 2010, the final fight. Are you going to play this game yet? Come on, play this game. Come on.
Did you beat the game?
I got to the second planet.
That's as far as I've ever made it.
I game genie my way through the end, and at the end, it's like, they reveal that the cyboplasm, or whatever it's called, is broken out on Earth, and then Ken has to go fight it. So it's not even the final fight.
Yeah, and like, he's so mobile, but none of the stages are really like built in such a way to let you really take advantage of that and play with that. It's a lot of interesting choices.
Yeah, he can backflip, and he's kind of invincible during that backflip, but there's not a really good way to ever use it because you're probably going to land in a bad spot where you're going to get like this rocket flying enemy going to hit you anyway.
That was the backflip is the key, I think, to understanding this game, because I played through it and I couldn't get past like the third level boss. Like, this game is too ridiculously difficult. So I Googled around, and there's this one Japanese website that's been around forever called Game Commander. And he put up a little write-up of some strategies, and he's like, the backflip is the key to this game. And he even stressed that apparently the Japanese manual actually said, you're invincible during this backflip, so you need to use that. And I checked the American manual, doesn't mention that at all. So maybe if that little key bit of information made it through, people would have understood this game, because I certainly didn't. But being able to use that to maneuver around definitely made the game easier, but there's still a lot of things in the like walls and things to climb onto and get caught on that makes it difficult to use effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes it possible. But even then, like, to beat any of the bosses, I watched like an Awesome Games Done Quick, and you really just kind of have to cheese them. Mm-hmm. Like the third level boss, you just find where he appears and just mash the button so you kill him. There's one particularly difficult boss later. The level is going up and down. You have this, it's like a clam thing that kind of hovers at the top of the screen. You have a dragon that's coming from the bottom of the stage, and if it gets you, it drags you down beneath, and you have to fight up again and restart the whole battle after that. And like this, I still don't know how to beat it properly, but the guy who beat it in the Awesome Games Done Quick, he just had this little power up, like a little option beside you, and you just be able to maneuver it so it killed the boss automatically. And there's a lot of this game that reminds me of being like a proto treasure game, and that it does sort of remind me of Alien Soldier, and that is like mostly a boss rush with stuff in between. And there are very specific, peculiar ways you need to play the game in order to beat it. And it's not as fun as a treasure game because there aren't any really unique weapons or anything fun like that. Like, it just is really difficult and punishing. But it reminds me of the way the design philosophy eventually went. So it's neat in that way, even though I can't say I really enjoy the game that much.
Yeah, I think this game, if it had more health drops than it does, would probably be a little more acceptable. But, like, it's so hard to power up your attack. And then, yeah, you know, you'll die, and then you'll have to start all over.
Like, powering up attacks, and not only, like, you can power them up a little bit, and you can punch further, do all the things just a little bit further, just a way out of, get yourself out of danger. But after you get to a certain level, you get hit, and your power level goes down again to, like, it kind of cuts off after, think, like, the second level or something. But, like, it's really hard to keep that, you just got to keep going and hope you don't get hit.
And also, if, you know, when you finish a section, a little gate will open up. And yep, some of the times these gates appear off screen and you have to find it. And if you don't find it within, you know,
you have like
I think,
5 seconds to find it, too.
Yeah. And then you just die and you have to start all over from level one attack power.
To me, that is really, really the game killer, is the fact that you can go through all these levels, which can be sometimes just a boss fight. Sometimes it's fighting tons of little riffraff battles, guys. Sometimes you have to do both. Sometimes there's a lot of platforming or scrolling involved. It really, it's all over the place. There's a lot of variety in how the levels are structured. But in every case, you have to find the portal, and there is no indication that I'm aware of that says, hey, the portal's over here. So you have to, like, know, hey, I won, and there's a portal, and I know exactly where the portal is, and I'm going to get through it in the brief time allocated to me, or else I'm going to do this all over again.
Yeah, like, it doesn't even, it kills you at that point.
Yes, it kills you if you don't make it to the portal. You just die instantly, even if you've beaten the stage. It's a weird, weird design choice.
One of the main designers was supposed to be Hisashi Yamamoto, who was also one of the arcade Ghouls and Ghosts guy, which, like, well, that definitely kind of makes sense, that level of punishing game design play.
Now I see.
Yeah, it checks out.
Yeah, the one thing that was really kind of weird to me that I wasn't expecting is how the game plays with your expectations in a little bit. When you transport between different worlds, you're not just going to the next boss or the next battle. Sometimes there's these weird interdimensional portal where you're just stuck in between, and there may not be nothing there, and it just opens up another gate. Or sometimes there's power-ups. Or sometimes you got to fight frogs, I guess.
that part is really cool. I really like the psychedelic backgrounds of there.
Yeah, I like the idea of how you're supposed to travel through these stages. They just make it as unfun as possible to do it.
So yeah, Capcom spent some time trying to figure out what are we going to do with this Street Fighter thing. It's neat, it's a good idea, it's got promise, but what do we do? And it wouldn't be until 1991 and Street Fighter 2 that they would finally nail it, but we'll talk about that in a future episode. I think that's really, we've said more than enough about Street Fighter 2010 and have talked pretty thoroughly about Street Fighter 1. So rather than belabor the point, I think we should call it a day here. And in a month from now, the Street Fighter 2 episode will be hitting the feed. So please look forward to that. In the meantime, let's wrap up here. This is a patron exclusive episode, so I don't need to belabor the point of what Retronauts is or how to support us through Patreon, because if you're listening to this, you already know. Thank you for supporting us and making this episode possible. But I will open the floor to everyone to talk about where we can find their various podcasts and other ventures. So, John, let's start with you.
Okay. Hi, I'm John Hurst. I go by Johan Hatt on Twitter, J-O-H-A-N-N-H-A-T, and I am one half of the duo that runs the podcast Video Death Loop, where we watch a short video clip on loop until one or both of us cannot take it anymore. So usually a lot of different, sometimes pop culture, sometimes weird commercials, sometimes just a weird clip I want to annoy my co-host Aaron with. So, you can find more information on that on the Greenlit Podcast Network at videodeathloop.com.
And Kevin.
So I run the Atari Archive YouTube channel, which is a chronological run through the Atari 2600 library. I'm just wrapping up 1980 as of this recording. I also have the AtariArchive.org website, which, you know, I have my release date listings and few articles up on there. I've got a Patreon for it under Atari Archive. And I'm on Twitter as Ubersaurus, which was my old Street Fighter handle. So tying that back in.
All right. And Kurt.
So I run Hardcore Gaming 101. We put out books pretty regularly. There's going to be a gigantic book about Japanese RPGs, which should be due out this summer. Putting out a follow-up to our guide on shoot 'em ups eventually, and then another book about beat 'em ups. And we also run a podcast at top 47 858 games of all time. That's at hardcoregaming101.net. And I'm on Twitter at hg_101.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter as GameSpite. You can also check me out doing stuff not only here at Retronauts, but also at Limited Run Games. And on my YouTube channel, which is just under my name, Jeremy Parrish, where I'm doing kind of like Kevin, but instead of with Atari games, it's with Nintendo and Sega games and a little bit of Atari games, but mostly Nintendo and Sega. So check that out. And yeah, other than that, I guess that is all. So thanks, guys, for helping me to lay out the history of the original Street Fighter. Look forward to a Street Fighter 2 episode in a month. And we'll be back on Monday with another Retronauts episode. Until then, remember, you've outlasted the best, and you are now the strongest Street Fighter in the world.